From the early days of a novel coronavirus to today, one full year later. We continue now with In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a pandemic destined to become sharply political. We begin with our Dakota political junkies. Tom Dempster and Kevin Killer are with us. We'll talk about the politics of COVID-19 against the backdrop of a national election and political aspirations. Then we check in with school districts and municipalities across the state for a look at how South Dakotans have endured 12 months of the contagion. We head to Chamberlain, Pierre, Mitchell, and Huron. We'll talk about shuttered businesses and open schools, remote learning and national press, mask mandates and accusations, conflict and community. It's all coming up after the news. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned the rape conviction of a South Dakota man. At trial, the federal prosecutor brought in an expert witness to tell what characteristics a rape victim might display. But the judge would not allow the defense to allege that the victim's trauma might have come from an earlier rape. Victoria Wicks has more of this story for SDPB.
Xavier Zephyr was convicted of raping a sleeping woman who awoke to find him on top of her. At trial, Zephyr was found guilty of aggravated sexual assault. He appealed his conviction and is represented at oral arguments by Molly Quinn. She tells judges that the jury heard the experts say that rape victims might suffer from substance abuse, self-harm, and mental health problems. And then the jury heard the victim testify to having those same symptoms.
The alleged victim's testimony about her drug use, self-cutting, and mental health problems conclude, based on that matchup, that she had in fact been raped, and in the absence of any evidence of another perpetrator, determined that it was Zephyr who did it.
Quinn says Zephyr had reason to believe that the victim had been raped some years earlier, but he wasn't allowed to present that evidence and suggest that the victim's trauma came from that experience. Assistant U.S. Attorney Jennifer Mamanga tells judges that this case is not simply he says, she says. The government presented DNA evidence and two additional accusers. Mamanga also says the defense cross-examined the victim and her mother about their difficult home life and the abuse both of them had suffered in relationships.
The defense certainly wasn't limited to just this purely sanitized victim who had no other alternative reason for why she might have some of these PTSD-esque type symptoms.
In its opinion, the Eighth Circuit panel recognizes that the sexual history of rape victims is not allowed as evidence. But in this case, the existence of a prior sexual assault is relevant. With conflicting testimony and little physical evidence of trauma, the court says it's not absolute that the jury would have found Zephyr guilty if he'd been allowed to present a full defense. The panel remands the case for a new trial. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
South Dakota lawmakers are taking their initial steps to redraw legislative districts, but they have been warned they will likely be working on a tight timeline and with census data that is less accurate than in previous years. Lawmakers held their initial meeting in the nearly year-long process to discuss a timeline and potential pitfalls for redistricting. The U.S. Census Bureau says it won't be delivering data used for redrawing districts until the end of September. Instead of the months that lawmakers have had in previous years to pore over census data, they will only have weeks to meet a December 1st deadline. A former South Dakota state senator has pleaded no contest to making a false domestic violence report against her ex-husband. A magistrate judge gave Lindy DeSanto a suspended 90-day jail sentence, which means she would only serve the time if she violates terms of her probation. Judge Todd Hieronymus granted a request by DeSanto's attorney for a suspended imposition of sentence, which allows defendants to have their first conviction sealed if they successfully complete their sentence. DeSanto was also ordered to pay a $250 fine. Her defense attorney entered the plea on DeSanto's behalf. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for the southwest and northeast until later tonight. In addition to that, a winter weather advisory in effect for parts of central South Dakota, stretching to the northeast as well as the southwest. Later this evening, cloudy skies with a chance of snow in the west, snow in the northeast, and rain and snow likely in the southeast, then a slight chance of rain. Coming up next, we're back within the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
on the next Fresh Air, MIT professor Sherry Turkle, who spent decades studying the impact of digital technology on our culture. She has a new memoir about growing up in Brooklyn and becoming a leading academic, and about family secrets she only understood when she began asking questions in her 20s. Her book is called The Empathy Diaries. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, presenting Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ, March 27th in the Washington Pavilion of Sioux Falls. Tickets available at sdsymphony.org.
What do you do with the pieces of a broken heart?
We ask the big questions, and sometimes we even answer them. I'm Larry Gross. Join us each week for Mountain Stage, live performance radio from NPR.
Listen Saturday evening at 6, 5 Mountain, and Sundays at noon, 11 Mountain on SDPB. Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. COVID-19 has been with us for a year now, and while adults are getting vaccinations, the process is going to take time. Looking back on the outbreak, why did this virus become such a political issue? And how has the pandemic affected things like elections and the overall political debate? It's time for our Dakota Political Junkies segment, and we're joined today by Tom Dempster, former state senator for the state of South Dakota. Tom, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Lori. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, you were following, the R-naught numbers and, the outbreak, the science behind it, the modeling, really early on as we traversed this pandemic together. And at the same time, you were paying attention to the messaging and the politics of COVID-19. When was think back to a year or so ago, when did it start becoming something that was on your radar as being, this is different than what we saw with Ebola, or this is different than what we saw with Zika, or what we saw with a seasonal influenza? When did it kind of hit you that we were in new territory?
Lori, it hit me when I was in Los Angeles, and my daughter, who lives in Los Angeles, looked at me and said, "I think I better go to the grocery store and stock up." And I looked at her and I said, "Really?" And she says, "Really." That's when it first struck me.
Yeah. Bishop Constanza Hagemeyer was just on with the ELCA, South Dakota Synod, and she said, right away she was referring to it as an ice age, not a blizzard, in the sense that it will change everything and how we talk to one another, how we live our lives, how we worship, how politics works. Have you seen that happen in the political realm, that really it was a seismic shift?
Let's not just say politics. I talked to probably three or four of my friends last night, and I asked them the question that I asked them. I said, COVID has been with us for a year. Tell me about it. And every time, Lori, every time the response was, "Oh my," and then the response was silence. And as I think about this year, I mean, it's been a year that isn't measured by a year, but a kind of forever. I mean, it's a suspension of everything, and in this political year, a suspension even of belief. It's a year for me of no weddings, no funerals, no birthdays. I got rear-ended a couple of days ago by a 30-some-year-old Hispanic woman who had spent 30 days in Avera, almost dying of COVID. And she tells me that when we got sick alone. And when we died, we died alone. Boy, it's almost as if all of this has been in secret, as if we were done away. I mean, I cry at funerals. I cry at weddings. I certainly cry at the birth of new babies. And soon it will be time for tears of both joy and grief.
So I'm going to go back to that, you know, getting in a car accident. And now the conversation after the car accident is at a level of depth that you wouldn't think if you got rear-ended, you would be sharing that sort of thing about your life. That is, it seems to illustrate your point that we're all a little bit more, you know, without the coverings and without the armor or almost without skin, as we go in the world, we feel that vulnerable and that open to sharing that kind of story. We get sick. When we got sick alone. When we died alone. That's quite a conversation after a fender bender, and I hope everyone's okay.
Well, yeah, yes, absolutely. But I mean, even Laurie, when we take a look at COVID deaths themselves, most obituaries don't list COVID as a cause of death. It's almost as if it's a matter of shame. It's as if
why is that? Do you think? Yeah, why is that? Because I've wondered about that. Yeah,
it's a matter of shame. If you can believe that, and it's as if people will then pull away and ask if they have any contact with the deceased, with the family, or if they're friends. Then mostly, I mean, these COVID deaths that we know of are mostly not names but numbers. I mean, I think 2,000 some people in South Dakota, 500,000 people in the United States, numbers but not people, except my friend over there and that family over there. I don't know.
Yeah. I want to ask you this because Governor Kristi Noem is on national news talking about, you know, 1 year of COVID in South Dakota. And everyone at this point, you know, we're doing it. We look back on a year and everyone is sort of telling the narrative, you know, from, you know, 30,000 feet at this point. Like, what do we know now that we didn't know then? And there is a sense of political shape shifting to say this is what we want to remember. And I don't just mean the governor. I mean all of us as we tell the stories. These are the things that we're going to remember. These are the things that we're just going to forget. Talk about the politics of that, of the governor coming out a year later and saying, you know, I talked to constitutional lawyers and I decided not to shut down. And the media spread fear. And we did the right thing. It's way more nuanced than that, of course. But talk about the politics of sort of telling the story a year later and what that messaging might be like.
It's a year when we claimed victory because we didn't reach the horrible estimates of the Imperial College, because we didn't have the forecasted 2.2 million deaths, or 70% of South Dakotans get infected. It's a year where politically we claim victory by marking hospital capacity, but we refuse even to set standards of voluntary behavior of mask wearing, as we send 20-year-old nurses and 40-year-old doctors into a war zone where the standard of care is moving so fast that what you couldn't do for the patient who died yesterday, you can do for the patient who won't fully die today. I mean, and we've seen this, it's a year when lies become truths, and the more you lie, the more people will call it the truth. It's astonishing.
Does it continue?
It's even a year where the big lie becomes the big truth, motivates an attack on the Capitol, and democracy itself trembles.
Does it continue in that direction as you look at the signs with a new administration and vaccines rolling out at a pretty, you know, speedy clip? When we get back to some kind of normal across the country, do we forget the lessons that we learned? Do we learn things and say never again about certain things? Do you have a precedent for what we can expect to... It seems like we're pretty good at forgetting in this country certain things.
If you remember Walt Whitman's poem about the election of, what, 1868, something like that, and it was an election called The Choosing, and he said it's a whole, he says, it's not Niagara Falls, it was the greatest thing, it's not the Great Plains, it's not Yellowstone, it's the people, and not in the chosen, but in the choosing, as he talks about Election Day. In my opinion, Lori, I mean, and we've talked about this before, many of our leaders failed in the cardinal virtues of prudence, of temperance, of fortitude, and justice. But Lori, as a people, we did not fail in those cardinal virtues. That's strength.
I want to talk about a friend of ours that we lost in 2020, not from COVID-19, but to cancer, and that's Rick Holm. And the first time I think I heard him on SDPB, you had interviewed him. And I sat back and listened to that warm and just wonderful conversation between the two of you. And then he became a weekly guest on In the Moment before he died. He had so much to say about caring for one another, about standing up and doing the right thing, about public health, about medical marijuana, about, you know, so many things. And again, I wasn't able to go to a funeral. Do you feel, so I want to get back to this idea of grief delayed. When you lose friends like that, who have such an influence on your life, people have lost family members. I lost my brother in 2020. And we hit pause and we compartmentalize because there's so many things going on. How do we move forward from that kind of collective and yet deeply individual trauma?
I'm sorry to hear about your brother. I did not know that. And my condolences.
Thank you.
As I said, this is a kind of forever. It's a suspension of everything. It's a year of grief, but not of grieving. But I look forward. We've all had friends who have died, some of COVID, some not of COVID. We've not had that opportunity to actively express that emotion of grief. And dare I say, I'm looking forward to going to these funerals that were suspended. I'm looking forward to going to these funerals so that we can take this session, this year of grief, of death, of redemption, and ultimately of new life. I'm very much looking forward to doing that.
Yeah. I'll just share, you know, one personal story about that time. We did have a funeral for my brother, although it was, you know, modified in a lot of ways outdoors, and there were different restrictions in Minnesota where he died. But before he died, we, you know, he had cancer and he'd been very sick for 4 years. And we went up to see him, and, you know, we all sat in the backyard and, you know, had our masks on. We were far apart because there was just no way, Tom, that I was going to be the person, you know, to unexpectedly bring COVID to my brother who was hanging by a thread. And before we left and said goodbye, which turned out to be our last goodbye, he said he wanted a hug. And I just remember standing there thinking, well, what kind of decision are you making? There was so much, weight at that moment to say, if you don't hug him, that will be the last time when you chose not to hug him. And if you do hug him and something happens and he gets ill, then it was you who did it. And we held our breath and we hugged. that was our compromise. And I was just going to come in really quick, and he just would not let me go. And in that case, I'm very glad that I did that, because that was the last time I saw him. And I just think of that's a small thing, you know, because he'd been sick so long and we knew that he was suffering. So many people have gone through agonizing, watching their parents with dementia, you know, deteriorate because they can't come visit, or, you know, making choices about their college students or themselves. It just has been a year of that weight of personal responsibility. You know, we celebrate it in some ways and we're grateful for it in some ways. On the other hand, just all those decisions and all that responsibility has just got to be really heavy on some days for so many people.
Well, and it's, whether it be my new Hispanic friend who hit me the other day, or for certain, whether it's 500,000 families across the United States, not to mention our friends internationally. Mm-hmm. There is just an absolute, and we will come here. There is a great sense of optimism and hope, but it is that deep recognition of loss and that expression of loss that gives us the that gives us the ability to be human again.
Yeah.
You die of COVID as a sense of shame. That's inhuman. Mm-hmm. That's why I take such great pleasure. I mean, you've got to take a look at the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. Had they not done what they did, had they not guaranteed every corporate bond in the world, we would have been flat on our back economically. We didn't have institutions like Avera and Sanford and Monument who sent their people into this war zone. Think of where we would be. We didn't mm-hmm. have some of our local government officials. If we didn't have Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, these people are heroes. These people are all, here we go again, prudence, temperaments, fortitude, justice. We have it and we can do this.
Yeah. We have it and we can do this. Tom Dempster joining us today for our Dakota Political Junkies conversation. He's a former state senator from South Dakota. Tom, thank you so much for being here. It's just, it means a lot to me.
Thank you, Lauren.
We are going to take a trip around the state from Chamberlain to Huron to Mitchell and to Pierre, checking in with school districts and municipalities about a year of COVID in South Dakota. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Journalist Jonkelin Hill could not get out of her head the story of an 8-year-old who went missing in D.C. Relisha Rudd disappeared from a homeless shelter 7 years ago.
She's this little black girl, and I was once a little black girl, and I know we're often aren't afforded the vulnerability that other girls are given.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign. SDPB.org/support.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. I'm Lori Walsh, and today we're looking back at 1 year of COVID in South Dakota. At the beginning of the pandemic, Governor Kristi Noem ordered state schools to close their doors for aggressive cleaning. That one-week break turned into remote learning across the state, followed by a summer of planning and decision-making about back to school. Justin Zeitz is the superintendent of the Chamberlain School District and joins us now for a look at the year that was. Superintendent Zeitz, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Not a problem, Lori. Thank you.
Give me a little bit of an idea, you know, those first days when Governor Noem said it's time to clean your schools, and then, you know, things were sort of scrambling to figure out how remote learning could work, what who was falling through the cracks in the early days and the recovery. Take us back and walk us through, in hindsight, some of the things that were the biggest challenges and some of the things that went well.
Right. So a year ago, I was in a different position over in Mitchell, South Dakota, the principal of the middle school. And so kind of looking at it from a completely different role, we were fortunate over there. We had met as the administrative team probably early February and started planning for one of two scenarios. If you remember last year, we had a lot of snow. A lot of rain in the fall, and we actually had to close our doors early on in the school year for flooding. And so we started to plan for, first off, if all the snow melts at once and we get a lot of rain, we're going to have to close school. And the second scenario was COVID really was starting to pick up and snowball over in China. And so our superintendent said, there is a possibility we have to close our doors because of COVID. And so we were fortunate. I met with all my teachers and I said, from here on out, I want you guys to be thinking, how do we start planning for a closure for flooding or a closure for a pandemic, in this case, without losing a minute of instructional time? And so my teachers had a couple weeks heads up that, you know, something's not quite right here. And so they started switching to Google Classroom. And really over there, it was a seamless transition into what we knew as e-learning in the spring. Now, none of us could have guessed it would have been the entire rest of the spring. And there's been a lot of things that we've learned during that time and since then.
Yeah. Tell me what some of those things that we learned, you know, first of all, how to do it well, how to do remote learning that is effective as possible.
Right. So that is a big question you just asked, because as we in education know, it's not a one-size-fits-all for everybody, and what works for one of our students is going to be a complete flop for another one. And so really it becomes, how do we get the students into the class that works best for them? You know, teacher A might do live Zoom every day, where teacher B might do post the lessons and do them at your own time. We have a lot of our students, our high school students, that maybe our daycare for our elementary age students during the day, and so they have to do their coursework at night. And so it's still, like many things in education, it comes down to building that rapport with the kids and getting to know them in order to do it well. I think we learned very quickly. Again, it's something that those of us that are in the building every day, we already know, but school is so much more than education. Last spring, cutting off those students so quickly from their friends, from the structured activities, led to a mental health crisis. I recall last spring making welfare check calls from my front porch a couple times a day, three or four a week, that really the kids are just struggling because they're not with their friends. We learned school provides stability. For a lot of our kids, it's the two meals a day that they can count on. So all of those things are they went into consideration when you started planning for the fall and how do we correctly reopen.
Yeah. What do you know at this point as far as what has been lost? Is this a, you know, we're going to be this far behind in math? Is this, you know, when you look at sort of what you can tell from the instructional period or from testing, is that even a question that should be asked, you know, right now? Or do we just all agree that we've, you know, we've lost a lot, we just have to get back to work? Like, how do you approach, you know, academically what has been missed?
Right. In the superintendent role, you're always looking at the data. What does it tell you? How effective is the instructional time? And, you know, we all know we've lost a lot of instructional time. I will say that we are not in the same boat as a lot of schools across the nation. Some of those schools haven't even gone back to regular in-person learning. So everybody is focused on the what have we lost. Well, we haven't lost as much as we could have. And it's, to me, it's no different than, okay, we have a kid who has fallen behind. How do we catch them up? Well, you put them in the classroom with a phenomenal teacher, and that teacher is going to work to catch those kids up. It's what they do. We know the statistic that a good teacher in elementary school can catch up, you know, 1 or 2 years' time in a year, whereas a bad teacher, you can lose 1 or 2 years. That's why we focus so hard on hiring the best teachers. And I know that puts a lot on the plate of those teachers, but we're here for the kids. That's what they do. So we have lost things, but I don't think it's something that is insurmountable. I do think from everything we've learned and how we've continued this year, we're going to catch those kids back up.
Yeah. Many teachers have waited a long time to be on the vaccination list, and they are now there. Tell me a little bit about teacher enthusiasm or hesitation for getting their vaccines, because teachers have been through a lot.
They have been through a lot. It's a question that, you know, ever since it was approved in December that I answered weekly, when are we going to be able to get the vaccine? When are we going to be able to get it? You know, the state initially told us February, and then for whatever reason, it kept getting pushed back. When I finally told my teachers, and Chamberlain was fortunate, we have a lot of students from Crow Creek, and so we worked with them and Indian Health Services, and we actually are sending our teachers tomorrow for the second round of vaccine. So we're 4 or 5 weeks mm-hmm. ahead of where we could be. When I sent out that email to staff saying, okay, here's the date, here's the sign-up sheet, we can get this taken care of, there was a sigh of relief across the district. I want to say tomorrow afternoon at this time, 40% of my staff will be fully vaccinated.
Nice.
With a number of them now heading, it is a relief. Number of them will head over to Sanford in a week. A number of them will head downtown to the pharmacy. There's so many avenues that we can do it now. We no longer have to worry about closing because we don't have staff.
Yeah. What do you wish you knew then that you know now?
There's a lot of things I wish I knew back then a year ago that I know now. Definitely probably the biggest thing is, you know, this sounds so mundane, but when we switched to e-learning last spring and Chamberlain ended up switching this fall to e-learning, I wish we would have prepared step-by-step directions, how to, for Google Classroom, for all of these learning management systems that we have, because it becomes very easy for somebody to say, I don't know how to do this. We best put it off until we can get a hold of somebody, you know, a repository, if you will, of directions for parents, for guardians, for whoever, just to take the time to do that and say, okay, here's a how-to video. Here's a step-by-step guide to upload the assignment, you know, and that I think would have saved everybody a lot of headaches.
Oh, Superintendent Zeitz from Chamberlain School District, thanks so much, Dr. Zeitz. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
We are checking in with municipalities and school districts across the state as we look back at 1 year of COVID-19 in South Dakota. Kelly Gloat is the superintendent of the Pierre School District. Dr. Gloat, thanks for being here.
Yes, glad to be with you.
We were just talking about things that we wish we had known at the beginning of the pandemic with Superintendent Zikes there. And I'll start with that question for you. Looking back at where your school district was a year ago, are there things that you wish that you would have known or had access to as you entered the first days of this pandemic?
Oh, I think without question, you know, I mean, that was in many ways, that was the toughest part of the entire situation, is that we were dealing with so many unknowns and so many changes that happened in pretty rapid succession that, you know, we don't like to be reactive in education. We'd prefer to be proactive. And that was pretty hard to do earlier in the school year. So, but that said, I couldn't be more happy with the way that the school year has progressed for us, and the fact that we were able to stay in session pretty much the whole time, except at the high school for a small break for when we did the hybrid and made some modifications to our protocols, and then got back to the goal of healthy kids and staff being in school, and if they're sick, not in school. So there were so many things early on, and I think, you know, for probably years to come, we're still going to continue to learn things that if we would have known, that things might have been different. But I still can't thank our staff and our students and the parents enough, because it has been, considering the situation, it has been a tremendously positive and successful school year. So I'm just very thankful that that we're where we are, and that we're in South Dakota. I mean, when I watch the national news, my heart just bleeds for these kids that haven't been in school since last March, and I can't even imagine that. It's I think they need to maybe spend a little more time talking about some of the success stories and some of the places where we have had kids in school. And we've had challenges, but we've met those challenges, and we've had a successful school year. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that I wish we would have known in August. But looking back at that time, I don't know that we would have done anything overly different than what we did. So it's been a good year.
Talk to some of those superintendents in other states who are trying to figure out how to re-engage and get kids in the classroom. What are some of the best practices that you have found to make that transition a little smoother for them?
Well, you know, I think everybody, and I think one of the hidden positives of the whole situation is there's never been as much communication between school districts, whether it's within your regions, regardless of size, or whether it's just with, you know, we used to have meetings on maybe a monthly basis with our regional counterparts or colleagues, and maybe even less than that with, like, for our example, the large school group. But not this year. I mean, we started off, we were meeting with both of those groups and many other groups, DOE and Department of Health, on a weekly basis, and we have just recently kind of cut those back because there's still a lot of decisions to be made in finishing this school year strong. And so I think there's been some tremendous communication amongst all those groups, and I think we have certainly learned a lot from each other. So those conversations were happening throughout the year when it came to revisions of mitigation efforts. You know, I think early on we learned quickly that we were quarantining kids and having kids at home because they were close contacts at school for considerable lengths of time, and maybe they had more than one quarantine session because they were a close contact. And while we did better than ever when it comes to providing distance education, it's still not the same, and some of the revisions we made to get kids and staff back in school faster, I think, have been very positive and very welcomed by the parents and the students and the staff.
Yeah.
So it were comes there back things, to the mitigation efforts.
Yeah. So were there mitigation efforts that you found to be successful when it comes to, like, you know, plexiglass dividers or students wearing masks or, you know, reducing the number of kids in a hallway? Was it a combination of all those things? Like, how do you keep them healthy when they are in the classroom? Yeah.
Yep, I think a very wide variety of different efforts, and at the same time, individualized to each building and each level. Mm. For example, in we started the school year without a mask mandate. We eventually have a mask mandate at the middle school and the high school, but we never did have a mask mandate at the elementaries, and had our cases and the number of cases increased at that level, we would have. But we didn't need to make that change. So, and not that we still have a number of kids at the elementary that do mask, but it's not required. It's only recommended. And had those, so there again, I get back to kind of the reactive part of it. Had we seen, we have some of our elementaries with almost 500 students all year long. Total, they had 7 cases. So, you know, there's a lot of that depends on, like you said, class sizes and the very simple things that go way back to the beginning of hygiene, washing their hands more often, the little things, coughing into their sleeves, and, you know, keeping kids home that are sick and healthy kids in school. So I wouldn't point any one issue as being the factor.
I remember one of the early conversations I had on this program with Dr. Shankarkura, who was just talking about hand washing. And I just asked him, like, is that all you've got? Like, this is a pandemic. And he's like, no, that's not all we have. But really, it's incredibly important. And I think all of us learned, if we didn't already realize, how important it is to wash your hands and not touch your face, and then add things in like those distance and mask wearing. And Superintendent Gloat, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
No problem. Anytime, just let me know, and I'll give you at least one person's opinion or what we have tried to do in one district to make it a successful school year.
Perfect. Dr. Kelly Gloat is superintendent of the Pierre School District. We are going to head to Mitchell and Huron next. Mayor Bob Everson with Mitchell is on deck. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
Empty storefronts aren't a rare sight in New York City. A lot of businesses took a pause in this pandemic, but oh, what a difference a year makes.
Just a year ago, I was looking up bankruptcy laws, and a year later, I'm looking for a second space.
I'm Kai Rizdal. A comeback for commercial spaces. We'll have that story for you. The numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain. Thanks to your support, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is able to bring you live coverage of high school sports and fine arts events. We take pride in shining the spotlight on achievements of students in the classroom and on the stage. Support SDPB now and help us continue to offer high school sports championships and all-state music presentations. Donate at sdpb.org/donate.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament. You can catch all the action Thursday, March 11th through Saturday, March 13th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament is brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corn.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Governor Kristi Noem's response focused on not telling municipalities how to manage their own mitigation efforts. That provided opportunities and challenges for local leaders as they interpreted federal and state guidance, listened to their own business and healthcare leaders, and fielded calls from worried and sometimes angry residents. Home to the Corn Palace, Mitchell is a popular spot for tourists, especially during hunting season. Well, how has Mitchell managed the last year through a pandemic? pandemic? What's the local business climate? Is there any indication that stimulus checks from the federal government have helped matters? Bob Everson is mayor of Mitchell, and he joins us for an update. Mayor Everson, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
As you look back on this past year of, you know, opportunities and challenges, you know, wins and losses and so many deaths, what are some of the things that stand out to you that went really well and then things that you wish just they just needed to go better?
Well, I'd say overall COVID needed to go better. It was one of those years that, you know, you don't know what to expect. You know, when we started hearing that it was China was having issues with it and it could be coming over here, you know, your initial thoughts are, oh, it'll never happen to us. But then came March, and of course, a lot of challenges with it. We initially shut down the city for about a 30-day period, gathering places anyway. We did not close retail, but we closed bars, theaters, and those things. And as we progressed, we were able to see that, hey, you know, if we use common sense here, or what we believe was good common sense, good hygiene, social distancing, you know, work to those things, these places could actually be open, and they would probably be limited at least first in the number of customers they could have. But we weren't seeing a big takeoff of the virus here in Davis County, or specifically Mitchell. So through August, we were thinking we were doing okay. And then, of course, when we got to the fall, we got, like everybody else in the state did, the rather large influx of positive tests.
It even garnered coverage from the Washington Post as they came to town for the debate over a mask mandate. And I have my own opinions about that article, including the first line and the winds across the prairie, which I keep making a joke about. But and I shouldn't, because it's not funny. But the idea of someone else coming to a town like Mitchell and seeing it for the first time. When you look at that kind of coverage and the situation as it unfolded, was it a fair representation of how things were unfolding in Mitchell at the time?
In my opinion, no, not really. It was kind of weird that big of a publication was interested in our small community, but you know, they passed it off as, hey, you know, we're trying to do something on the mask versus no mask. And, you know, as I got into my interview with them anyway, it became pretty clear what the agenda was, and it wasn't one that I was real thrilled to be taking part in. You know, our mask mandate, we were debating it at that time. There was a strong group in council that wanted to have it, and there was roughly three members that didn't. We have an 8-person council, so the majority was leaning towards requiring a mask mandate. The three that were opposing the mask mandate, obviously, initially, or after discussion, initially went along with it. So we passed a unanimous mandate to require masks in public facilities and businesses, which, you know, whether you like them or not, I can't prove they work. I can't prove they don't work. But if you feel comfortable wearing a mask, we've said this all along, you know, whether or not there's a mandate on, if you feel the mask is working for you, you need to wear a mask. So for roughly 6 weeks, we are, the end of November through, I guess, almost through the month of January, we had a mask mandate. Well, a lot of grumbling. A lot of people did not care for that. I probably had far more opponents to it contact me than people that were happy with it. Obviously, we were having meetings, or I've go ahead.
Do you think it helped turn the tide, though?
In my opinion,
because the numbers were really going in a pretty dire direction, and then after the mask mandates were initiated, the numbers did turn around. Do you think that it helped contribute to that, or do you think it was a coincidental alongside?
I think it leans more towards coincidence. We were heading to a peak. And then we started down. We removed the mask mandate. We had gotten under 100 local cases. And since then, we've been down to 21, and we're back. I think we've gone back up to 31 local cases right now. That maybe that was a day or two ago that we were at 31 active cases. But I think we had reached a natural peak. Enough people had gotten it. We've now been seeing, of course, now we've been seeing the vaccination come in, which is very beneficial. And by no means am I trying to belittle this whole thing. You know, social distancing, sanitizing, a lot of hand washing, they absolutely help, and they were paramount in helping us keep this down. You know, what caused the peak? I don't know. I'm guessing it could be a lot of younger people, college age. We had the university come back. I'm not blaming the university by any means, but that tends to be a very social crowd. We had Mitchell Technical Institute come back. That tends to be a very social crowd, too. You know, they're late teens, early 20s, and they like to go out and do things.
I want to jump in because I want to ask you before we let you go just about those stimulus checks and some of the federal assistance and state assistance on employment. And are there things that you know, can you see the impact of that sort of propping up the economy? Any final thoughts on just how, federal stimulus money has helped or not over the past year?
I can't point to them literally helping us. I do think a lot of it went into savings accounts more so than being spent. We have been fortunate in that our sales tax rebounded in December. We were quite low, and that's kind of, you know, that's our main 58% of our budget comes from sales tax, and we were seriously concerned we were going to have a big issue with it, and it did rebound by the end of the year, and we have seen it fairly steady now. Of course, you know, online sales tax, I'm sure, was a big boost to that as well.
Bob Everson, Mayor of Mitchell. Mayor, thank you so much for being here with us today. Be well.
Thank you.
Some of South Dakota's first recorded cases of COVID-19 were in the community of Huron. Not only did the community have to do everything to protect itself, they also had to deal with complaints and accusations that those afflicted were immigrants employed by area packing plants. Mayor Gary Harrington won election to his seat months after the start of the pandemic, but he has seen its impact on his community and events like the South Dakota State Fair, and he joins us now. Mayor Harrington, thank you so much for being here.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, absolutely. It has been a year of COVID-19 in South Dakota, and Huron was one of the communities that Governor Kristi Noem held up in the beginning as sort of seeing an early surge and then getting some of those mitigation efforts right. We heard at many press conferences her talking about Huron and asking people to look to them to see what they had done. What are some of the things that you think your community got right in the early days?
Well, it's going to be also, it was a year ago, March 22nd, that we sat down with the county commission, joint meeting of the county commission and city commission, and said, what the heck are we going to do with this? You know, we were pretty fearful and didn't have all the answers to how bad it was going to be, but we decided we better do something. So we set out to set out some ordinances and some resolutions on how we wanted our businesses to conduct business in our town. And we started out by shutting our businesses down and then opened them up eventually for limited capacity. We went to 25% capacity, and most of the time our businesses throughout the first 3 or 4 months did curbside if they were restaurants and stuff like that. And some of them just recently stopped doing curbside, by the way. They opened up their doors. We did just pass a resolution that they can go from 50% to 75% at this time of capacity. So we did that. We also started out by looking at our mask ordinances, seeing what resolution we could do with that, how would be most effective. We didn't feel that we should put an ordinance out there to make it mandatory and charge somebody X amount of dollars or fine them or having our police go around and look at them. We asked our public to be part of the solution, not the problem. So many of them did. It was really good to see. Along with our churches and our businesses and our city hall and places like that, we still We still wear masks here in our city hall and our city buildings and stuff like that. We'll probably keep doing that for another couple months. But some of those things like that, we had a task force established that we would meet in for the first 2 or 3 months. We'd meet almost every day on a task force to find out what was going on and how we could make it better. We set up our own sampling facility where people could go provide samples. And then a couple of days later, they'd be known whether they had the virus or not. We did that right away. That thing is still going on. Along with the sampling center, we also had a system where we did contact tracing through our system. We had three phone operator people there working on that. So if somebody came in and had the virus, we could find out from them who they'd been in contact. We would then contact those people and say, hey, look, you've had contact with the person that's got the virus. This is what we want you to do from here on out. So things like that, really, that was the beginning. And I mm-hmm. think that's what some of the things that the governor was looking at the time, because we were a hot spot at the time for some reason. I don't know why we started out being a hot spot, but it wasn't long after that we started settling into a routine, and it helped our community by far. But, you know, it wasn't over. You know, on November 18th, we had 618 active cases. We got out there and fought amongst everybody with that. Just to show you where we've been now, at one time in February, we only had 48 cases active. Right now, we got 112 active cases. So we've come down like everybody else has come down.
Yeah, not over yet, definitely feeling a mastery of some of the fundamentals here, and those vaccines are rolling out quickly. In our last 30 seconds, Mayor Harrington, anything that you take forward that you learned about the people of Huron that you'll really never forget from this time?
Yeah, they'll step up, just like all of our communities in South Dakota have stepped up. And it took a while for them to understand, through the help of CDC and people like that, to explain the importance of doing what we need to do as far as the procedure and stuff. They follow them. And, you know, of course, you have some people that didn't believe in it, but, you know, that was the small minority of that. So we're very pleased and we're proud of our community, believe me.
All right. Mayor Gary Harrington, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
You bet. Have a good afternoon.